This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. 40 years ago today, an era began.
It's one small step for man.
The era when you could start sentences with, if we can put a man on the moon, then why can't we blah, blah, blah.
Okay, Houston, I'm on the porch.
It's time for us to buck up.
Roger, Neil. The surface appears to be almost like a powder. I'm going to step off the land now.
Congress, this administration, the entire federal government, to be clear...
It's one small step for man.
...that we've got to get this done.
One giant leap for mankind.
40 years after the Apollo moon mission, President Obama wants to pass health care reform in less than 40 days. A giant leap begins with 1,000 small steps. We'll find out how small on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, Diodato style. It's Thursday, July 16th. I'm John Hockenberry. And if we can put a man on the moon, why can't me and my co-host, Farai Chidea, be broadcasting from near-Earth orbit at this moment?
Right, in some kind of a spacesuit. Or we could just go to the Air and Space Museum and eat that, you know, crispy little, you know, deep-fried ice cream.
Oh, that's tasty, but I want the rocket. I want the jetpack. So we can ask that question to the acting head of NASA, who's going to be on the program just a little bit later. And as Obama rolls out his, literally, it's a political campaign to get Congress to pass health care reform, we've got a question for a doctor, friend of The Takeaway, family physician from Grand Junction, Colorado, Dr. Promenko, Michael Promenko. Good morning. So far, do you think this is a health care reform plan of small steps or of giant leaps?
I think there are some pretty big leaps included in the initial bill that we've seen here over the last 48 hours come out of the House.
Giant leap sounds pretty good. Stay with us, Doctor. We're going to have a full discussion of the what's and the hows of this latest health care plan that's emerged or may emerge from the House of Representatives in just a moment. Also, a look at netbooks. They're not books made out of fishnets. And day four of the Sotomayor hearings. That and more ahead. Right now, everything you need to know this morning in the headlines. President Obama takes up those health care issues we just talked about in a meeting with moderate senators later this morning. Tonight, the president addresses the NAACP Centennial Gathering right here in New York. We'll have live coverage of the speech at thetakeaway.org.
And the Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor will take a few more questions in Senate confirmation hearings. After that, senators call witnesses, including Frank Ricci, the Connecticut firefighter from the discrimination case Sotomayor ruled on. And this hour, we're standing by for the latest unemployment numbers.
Housing numbers are out already this morning. They show more than 1.5 million homes getting foreclosure papers in the first half of the year. One man is dead after a shootout just blocks away from where Justice Sotomayor testified. And lawmakers are debating health care in Washington, D.C., and the Wall Street stock market is ready to open flat this morning, gained about 3% yesterday. NASDAQ kicks off at 1862, the S&P begins at 932, and the Dow starts trading at 8616. Health care, that's what we've been talking about. If we can put a man on the moon, what would you pay for new health care? What would you pay for reform in terms of more benefits? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Your taxes may go up. What do you want to pay for to reform healthcare?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry with Farai Chidea. There's a lot to talk about, so let's get started. Right off the top, we've said on this program many, many times that the whole strategy for developing health care reform in the Obama administration couldn't differ more sharply than what was tried back in the 90s by the Clintons. Back then, you'll recall, the Clintons created a kind of think tank to develop a policy and then push it through Congress. Obama has done exactly the opposite. He has a broad vision, but it's Congress that's nailing down the details. And now today, the president apparently is rolling out an enormous national campaign to get the plan that is now emerging from the House that goes to the Senate passed by his deadline, which is the August recess for the House and the Senate. It's a challenging, tall order, and here to talk about it, we have a number of voices. Two of them are named Michael, my director points out to me, so you should get a pad and paper if you're playing along with us at home here on The Takeaway. Trudy Lieberman, a friend of The Takeaway, director of the Health and Medicine Reporting Program at City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, long-time contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, is here in the studio. Good morning, Trudy.
Good morning.
Also, a friend of The Takeaway, Dr. Herbert Pardis, the president and CEO of the New York Presbyterian Hospital, which is actually number one in the New York metro area and number six in the nation, according to the latest U.S. News and World Report's best hospital rankings. Dr. Pardis, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Dr. Michael Promenko, you heard at the top of the program, he's a family physician from Grand Junction, Colorado, and serves on the Colorado Medical Society's Congress for Healthcare Reform. Michael, thanks for staying with us.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
And with another perspective entirely, Mike Frederick is president of MCM Composites. He has 45 full-time employees. He is a small business, but not so small that he falls under the net for being required to insure his employees in some sense for medical coverage. He's in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Mike Frederick, thanks for being with us.
Hi, you're very welcome.
All right, let's start with you, Trudy. What are the policy implications? It seems to me there are two coming out of this House version, which goes on to the Senate. Number one, how it's going to be paid for, which involves people who make more than $350,000 a year. There's a tax in there. The possible taxing of benefits that exist now, that seems to be in this bill. And then there's also the question of an individual mandate. First of all, you know, what do you think is most important? And grab whatever you want there.
Well, I think we have to think about the what is the reform before we talk about what the financing is going to be. And largely, the what is an individual mandate, which means that people who do not carry insurance now will have to carry it in one way or another.
And that means everybody who is uncovered at this point, there's going to be a day of reckoning where they're going to have to pick up the yellow pages and go, I got to find insurance or else I'm in trouble.
That's correct. There will be some sort of exceptions or exemptions, but we really don't know what they are just yet. But by and large, most people will have to get insurance. And that means that the 45, 47, 50 million, whatever the number is right now, people who are uninsured will have to find insurance. Now, 85% of those people can't afford insurance or they would be buying it now.
There are subsidies in place, right?
There will be. That is what the money is going to be used for. The subsidies will be based on some sort of sliding scale up to some percentage of poverty. And in the House bill, it's 400%, which is something over $80,000 for a family. But my guess is by the time this is all finished and the Senate has its version, that it will be something much less.
Quickly, if you are $1 more than the sort of poverty threshold for this bill, what is it that is your out-of-pocket expense on this mandated insurance, do you think?
You will have to buy whatever you can afford. And right now, there are many, many policies on the market that are called high-deductible plans. That seems to be the new standard, in which there are huge deductibles, like $5,000, $10,000, and sometimes even more. And the higher the deductible, the more you have to pay out-of-pocket, the cheaper your premium will be.
But it's a five-figure expense probably yearly, $10,000 or maybe a little bit less.
The average family policy last year was over $12,000.
Over $12,000. Okay. Dr. Herbert Pardis, president and CEO of the New York Presbyterian Hospital, when you hear this individual mandate program, how does it change the way you do business, do you think?
Well, I think it's a healthy step for all of us because what that means is that if all people are insured, they'll probably have ongoing contact with some, let's say, general doctor or primary care doctor, so they've got access and continued contact with the system. That means that they're likely to have better health because they'll be willing to go for checkups and be in closer contact with their physician. And it means, in turn, that we'll have less people coming at much more sicker intervals to the emergency rooms, where they're already going to cost more money, they're going to have greater difficulties. I think it's a good step toward a healthier population.
All right, a good step. We'll get into some of the details because I already see Trudy Lieberman shaking her head here, and I want to get her comment. But first, Mike Frederick, let's talk about what Dr. Herb Pardis just said a moment ago. If employees are insured, they're likely to be healthier. Is that your experience in your small business, Mike Frederick?
people are going to do what they want to do. I mean, they're going to smoke if they want to smoke. If they're overweight, they're overweight. Every one of our employees has access to health coverage, and about half of them take it. Some of them don't because their spouses have it, and they can get, there's no reason to have two different sources of health insurance. But some of them just don't want to. Some of them are young. They don't need it. They have disposable income they want to spend somewhere else. I mean, I don't see that connection there between a healthier population and mandated government health care.
Okay, when you see mandated government health care, how does that affect your business, do you see, going forward?
Well, I see the whole game here, and if you try and read this bill, your eyes will cross. And at least I tried to read it, which is more than I'm sure a lot of people are going to vote for it will. But the game here is to start off with kind of a negative option. I mean, we have a health care plan right now that's a high deductible plan. It's $2,700 for individuals and $5,400 for families. However, the plan that we have offers $1 coverage for wellness. So if you go in for a physical, it's paid 100%.
Wow.
If you go in for a colonoscopy, 100%.
But only half of the people take advantage of those incentives,
yeah,
it sounds
their
like.
Choice.
All right.
They have it, they don't have it.
Got
it's
it.
Up to them.
Michael Promenko, you said at the top of the program, these are giant leaps. Quickly, a comment on what's already been said.
You know, it's important to remember right now that we are mandated in this current dysfunctional system to pay into the system. It might be hidden, but they're there. You know, whether you buy a product that's made in the United States, the classical example is the extra $2,000 or so that you pay for an American-made car because of the high expense of health care in this country. So as we try to shift the cost and make it much more logical, I think the idea of an individual mandate is a good one. And putting the responsibility a bit back on the individuals of these United States to contribute into the system, although with a subsidy for folks
okay.
that can't afford the full premium.
All right, so you've heard skepticism from a business owner. You've heard some optimism from a doctor practicing in Colorado and a sense that this is a good first step from a president and CEO of an important hospital here in New York. Fry?
Well, Trudy, you're director of this health and medicine reporting program at City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. On a practical level, I saw yesterday a lot of coverage of Massachusetts' decision to take a bunch of legal immigrants, not undocumented, but legal immigrants off the rolls. The governor, Deval Patrick, is fighting back against it. How long will it take to implement some of these changes? And in the meantime, how desperate are the states?
Well, the states are very desperate right now, and I think Massachusetts is among them. The model that we are going to have is based on Massachusetts, and I think it's important to remember there are serious problems developing up there that have not been fully discussed in the media or anywhere else.
Let's remind people of Massachusetts' situation. They have a statewide mandate, and as Farai just said, they can't afford it, and they're pushing people off the rolls to be able to afford it. Go ahead.
That's exactly what's happening, and I want to go back to a point that Dr. Pardis made that more people would stop going to the emergency rooms. That really has not happened in Massachusetts. The latest studies that I've seen show that there is still high emergency room use in Massachusetts. And a number of hospitals have told me that people are coming in with these high deductible plans that leave them uncovered, and the hospital has to try to collect.
So much to talk about. Dr. Herbert Pardis, President and CEO of New York Presbyterian Hospital, let's give you the last word. And again, there's an uphill battle in the Senate on this bill. Go ahead.
I think what's going to be involved here is collective responsibility. And I think we as individual citizens all through the country have to realize we play a role. A tremendous amount of the health care expense in this country is related to behavior. And when people talk about it, people want to smoke, they can smoke, they want to be overweight, we're going to be overweight. I think it's going to be, hey, after we brought the American people, that if they do those things, it has an effect on them, which is deleterious, and an effect on the general society.
All right. Well, Trudy Lieberman, Dr. Herbert Pardis, Dr. Michael Promenko, and Mike Frederick, it seems at the very least the takeaway from this discussion is we're going to pay for it either way. The question is down in the details, and this bill moves on to the Senate. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It is Tech Thursdays here on The Takeaway, and it is truly, truly, and honestly time for technology. If you don't have one of these, you've probably seen them around.
It is Tech Thursday. It is Tech Thursday.
We're talking about tiny laptop-like devices known as netbooks. They've been around since 2007, but now they're increasingly popular. You know, some people have their BlackBerries, some people have their iPhones, some people have a heavy laptop, but some people kind of want the best of both. Now, in recent weeks, both Google and Microsoft unveiled new programs designed specifically for netbooks. And joining us now to talk about why the netbook is so popular and where it fits in among the other gadgets out there is Matt Buchanan, contributing editor for the blog Gizmodo.com. And before we got started, you were saying, "Oh, I've got to do another blog post in 10 minutes." So good thing this segment is now got 7 minutes left. What's a netbook?
A netbook is basically a small, cheap notebook. It's, you know, around 10 inches, maybe a little less, maybe a little bit more.
Cheaper, but, right?
Yeah, they're cheaper. They're around, they're usually not more than $500. So, but most of them tend to hover around $400. A lot of them have 160 gigabyte hard drives. They're 10 inches. They're a lot nicer than they used to be for about the same amount of money. So they've changed a lot.
How do these compare? I mean, because when you say $500, can't you get a regular notebook now with much more power for $500?
Yeah, precisely. And that's, you know, that's sort of like the mystery of the netbook in a way, is they kind of fit into this weird space between smartphones and notebooks. People just want something they can throw in their bag.
Where is most of the data if it's not on the computer in the netbook configuration?
The idea behind netbooks is, you know, people are going to the cloud. They're using internet applications like Google Documents. And this kind of thing, so that way their stuff is online. It's not on the computer. So you've seen a lot of talk around the cloud, and that just means applications and data on the internet. Like you'd connect to Google or something.
You know, I've been using sometimes. I have one computer that has all the hard software, if you can use that term, another that uses the web-based software, the Google software, and one of the things that frustrates me is that you can't update documents when you're not online. Is that going to change?
Theoretically, with the Google's vision of the world, you'll have internet everywhere eventually, on airplanes, you know, upcoming wireless technology, 4G from AT&T and Verizon will have, you know, the equivalent of like Wi-Fi everywhere. So in this sort of web app vision of the world, eventually there'll be a point where there's almost nowhere you're not online.
And Google is willing to wait until the world gets to that point. But for right now, it sounds like you're saying that unless you're online, the netbook is kind of useless.
Yep, yeah, it is. I mean, I like
you would state it that strongly that they're useless.
They're designed to go on the internet, and in some ways, they're not even that great at that. Given, you know, the operating system that runs on them, that's why you see a lot of custom operating systems coming out for netbooks, like the Chrome OS. You know, Intel has their own called Moblin.
Now, there's enormous competition in this space, though, to dominate the operating system and the sort of protocol for these netbooks. Certainly, all these computer companies are betting that this is a very important space in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, there is dominance in the space. Windows XP dominates it. You have these Linux versions running around, but, you know, their market share is very, very small. I think something like 90% of netbooks are on Windows XP. People want something familiar on them. Even though I don't think XP is particularly suited to run on netbooks for various reasons.
Let's break this down in terms of a couple of different consumers. I'm going to run through three different types of consumers, and I want you to just give me a yes or no as to whether you think it would be good for this person. A six-year-old kid whose school uses personal laptops.
Awesome, great. Yep, great for them.
A business traveler who needs to do a lot of spreadsheeting and other sophisticated business documents.
No.
Video applications, forget it.
Video applications, forget it. I mean, there are a couple networks coming out with this new NVIDIA chip called Ion that does better graphics. Like, it'll output 1080p high-def video, but the program has to use the graphics to accelerate it. Otherwise, it's going to be really terrible and choppy. Like, high-def YouTube, forget it.
Finally, what about this scenario? A lot of families have stretched to buy computers. You know, you see a lot of families that stretched to buy desktops, and then laptops became increasingly popular. What about a family that is invested in having a computer, but they have to stretch to get it?
The thing about netbooks is that they're not as powerful as a normal notebook. And so the things that they'd probably want to do with a regular notebook, I don't think they'd be able to do very well with a netbook. Whereas you can get, you know, a 17-inch laptop for $600-$700, and you know you could do a lot more things with it. Microsoft ran like the Laptop Hunters ads a little bit ago, and they're still running them, showing you know how much computer you could get for the money. And you know, even these bigger, heavier things, you could do a lot more with them than you can with a netbook.
Now, Matt Buchanan, there were these things in the 90s called internet app computers, which were rolled out and failed. They didn't actually go anywhere. It seemed to me a sort of an initial version of the netbook that didn't really go anywhere. Who's to say this isn't going to happen this time?
A lot of people say this is going to happen this time. Personally, I think netbooks are a weird anomaly, a function of the economy and certain technological trends coming together at a particular point in time. And I don't know if they're going to have much of a shelf life, you know, in 2 or 3 years. Maybe. But you see smartphones coming up. You know, I can browse the internet on my iPhone perfectly well. And the next generation of them, probably even better. So why do I need this laptop that's not really that great and costs just as much as my phone?
Well, maybe because your hands will get all jammed up texting like mine are. But hey, that's just me. Bringing it home, Matt Buchanan, contributing editor of Gizmodo.com. Thanks so much. And now we have Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thank you very much, Rai. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. After Iran's crackdown on election protests, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told an audience at the Council on Foreign Relations that it will be harder to move forward with diplomatic talks.
Neither the president nor I have any illusions that dialogue with the Islamic Republic will guarantee success of any kind.
Secretary Clinton says that direct talks are still the best way to get Iranian officials to change their policies, but the option won't stay on the table indefinitely. President Obama continues his push for health care reform in the Oval Office today. He'll meet with potential Senate swing votes. That's as House Democrats plan to hold votes in two committees on the $1.5 trillion health care plan unveiled earlier this week. Also in D.C., Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor will finish answering questions from senators today in her confirmation hearings, and then testimony turns to witnesses. Just a few blocks from those hearings in the Capitol, a police shootout in Washington has left a man dead. Authorities say that he sped away from a routine traffic stop, hitting two officers before he finally crashed into a police cruiser. In international news, July is already the deadliest month yet for US-led forces in Afghanistan. Top uniformed officer Admiral Mike Mullen says the right manpower is in place and the goal is to encourage the locals to help themselves.
In the end, if we get it right for the Afghan people, the Afghan people will turn the Taliban out. And that's the answer in a counterinsurgency.
24 American troops died in Afghanistan this month. That's a look at your news for now.
Confirmation hearings, are they a good idea? We'll find out in a moment with Nate Persily from Columbia.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farhad today. We've got a challenge here on The Takeaway. All week long, we've been listening to the Sotomayor hearings, Sonia Sotomayor, for the Senate Judiciary Committee, trying to be confirmed as a justice, an associate justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. And there have been headlines and there have been sound bites, but we wanted to step back. And joining us now is Nate Persily, friend of The Takeaway, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, who we often rely on when we have pointy-headed questions about what's going on in law and the judiciary. First of all, Nate, good morning.
Good morning.
And, you know, help us out here. Is there anything in the Constitution that says that you have to have hearings like this that we have here in the 21st century where she's in the center, all the senators around, millions of cameras, the whole world is watching, that sort of thing?
No, you don't have to have hearings. The Senate has to vote on her confirmation, and by majority vote, they will either, you know, confirm or reject her.
So advice and consent could just be a voice vote.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, the voices are of senators asking questions. And the debate appears to have boiled down, at least in the big headlines, and I want to talk about that first, to this exchange right here.
Do you agree with them that the law only takes you the first 25 miles of the marathon and that that last mile has to be decided by what's in the judge's heart?
No, sir. I wouldn't approach the issue of judging in the way the president does. He has to explain what he meant by judging. I can only explain what I think judges should do, which is judges can't rely on what's in their heart. They don't determine the law. Congress makes the laws. The job of a judge is to apply the law.
Of course, that exchange from July 14th this week, Sonia Sotomayor and Senator John Kyle talking about judges and empathy. Now, Nate Persily, you're a professor at Columbia University, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, you know, a resident here of planet Earth. But it seems to me the idea that you don't ever look into your heart when you're a judge dealing with broad issues of law and justice is just absurd on its face. His question is absurd. Her answer is absurd. The whole thing is absurd. Am I nuts?
No, that's right. But it's also reflective of what these hearings have been about, which is that she is trying to run away from all of these statements that say, well, a judge's background is going to affect her or another judge's decisions. She's also running away from the empathy trope, which President Obama has brought out even before her nomination. And so she has been steadfastly trying to say, oh, the only thing that matters is the law and how I interpret it, and that there's some kind of objective truth out there that I'm discovering. It's not something about something in me to discover.
But isn't it the case that if a judge somewhere at some point didn't look into his or her heart, there'd still be lynching in the United States, or we'd still have segregated schools in the United States? I mean, at some point, didn't somebody have to, like, leave the logic zone and go into some sort of humanistic zone to advance the law?
Well, I think that that's happened actually since the beginning. I mean, it's not as if the words in the Constitution are so clear that they're going to decide cases. But the funny thing is, Sotomayor feels particularly compelled to make this argument. If you look at Justice Alito in his hearings, for example, he reflected on his background. He talked about his experience, his family's experience,
right,
as Italian immigrants, and
right,
he was allowed to say those things because no one was going to make the charge that he was somehow going to be biased in favor of Italians who came before the court.
Right, right,
but because
right.
of her Berkeley speech and these other quotes that have come up, she has to run away from this idea that a judge's background is going to determine outcomes.
All right. Once upon a time, when Justice Bork was in these similar hearings and didn't make it to the Supreme Court, as we know, it was a robust, vigorous, intellectually adventurous discussion of the law. Of course, it nailed him for the rest of his career. But that was the last time we've had a real discussion of the law and the judiciary in these kinds of hearings. Yes?
That's right. And I think since Bork, there's a playbook that nominees have to follow, which is that they have to reveal as little as possible and to pretend that they are completely open and haven't decided a lot of these controversial issues that everyone is interested in.
And if running away from an intellectual discussion of the law was sort of the lesson of the Bork hearings, you really hit a low point by the time you get to hear this moment in the Clarence Thomas hearings.
At no time did I ever indicate that I ever asked her out. I categorically denied that I ever asked her on a date.
That's why I asked you the question, Judge, to make sure it's on the record what you said. I thought that's what you had said, but it's been sitting out there.
One of those guys is vice president. The other one is a Supreme Court justice. My, how history changes from the 1980s. So since those two, Bork and Thomas, we've got this sort of kabuki theater thing.
Well, they also sort of exemplify the different bounds of these confirmation hearings. On the one hand, you know that the judge is not going to reflect anything about his or her ideology. And so therefore, you try to get something in their background, whether it's these comments that Sotomayor made in her speeches, whether it's clubs that they had been members of at some other point in their life. And so you go after those things, which are more likely to bury a nominee than sort of.
But the irony is, of course, they're all about the heart. You know, it's like if you're a member of a club, that's the heart part of your life, okay? If you're doing the law, you're doing the law. I mean, to ask about those personal details, it seems to me, is another contradiction. But finally, in listening to the hearings, there's been a lot of discussion of some really boring stuff, but it's been fascinating to me. Property law has come up, the Grassley conversation, even a discussion of corporate litigation, her discussion yesterday about the reason why we have gobbledygook in contract law. All fascinating stuff.
Well, I think the way to keep one's sanity in watching these hearings is principally to look at them as markers along our sort of path of constitutional development. You look at the issues like property takings, gun rights. There was even some reference Charles Grassley made to gay marriage.
Senator from Iowa. Yeah.
That these are types of issues that 30 years ago we wouldn't have been spending so much time in a confirmation hearing on. And so you shouldn't tear out one's hair trying to figure out, you know, the machinations of these hearings. But if you look at them as just a story in constitutional development, they're kind of interesting.
What's the takeaway from these hearings?
Well, I think that, you know, it is a historic appointment.
Right.
And all of this preoccupation with the wise Latina comment, her and judicial background, is, I think, in retrospect, say 30 years from now, we're going to be saying, right, wow, this was an example of our path onto, you know, a society where there's not going to be one racial group as a majority. It represents our diversity as a country.
Well, I'm looking into my heart, Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, and I think we're going to invite you back. Talking about the Sotomayor hearings with Nate Persily, day four begins today, and now Femi Okeh has our headlines.
Thanks, John. Lots of economic news out this morning. Let's start with fresh numbers just out on the job market. New claims for jobless benefits were down last week, mostly due to the timing of auto layoffs. 522,000 people filed for the benefits. News this morning from Wall Street. JP Morgan Chase says that its profits were up 36% last quarter.
Another bank doing well.
Yep, and that's all thanks to strong investments. JP Morgan Chase say that they would have made even more money if they hadn't had to pay back its TARP money. News on the housing front, not so good. New numbers show a 15% jump in foreclosures in the first half of the year. And the report comes from the listing service Realty Track. It says that more than 1.5 million homes were getting foreclosure papers, and that's just in the first half of this year. That's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning. John?
And 40 years ago today, NASA launched a mission to the moon. You know where you were?
I know exactly
you know
where I was.
Yeah,
yes.
I know where I was. We'll talk about that even in a moment. How has NASA's mission changed since then? What are we doing in space? We pose that question to NASA's acting administrator coming up on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Eric Dash, the banking reporter for The New York Times, joins us now in what seems to be a pretty happy week for banking. Good morning, Eric.
Hi, it's great to be here.
J.P. Morgan Chase posted second quarter profits a couple of days after Goldman Sachs posted a huge $3.44 billion revenue number for the most recent quarter. J.P. Morgan Chase gets $2.7 billion for this latest quarter, 36% jump from this time a year ago. Does it say the bailout, the bank bailout worked, or is this a vindication of J.P. Morgan Chase CEO and chairman Jamie Dimon?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that what you're seeing is sort of the market starting to stabilize. We're seeing blowout investment banking and trading revenues, and we're also seeing the sort of thinning of competition from last year. You know, there used to be, you know, five or six big investment banks. Now there's just a handful. And the same thing goes with retail banks, as we see sort of some of the big mortgage players exiting the business and mortgage brokers exiting the business as well.
So let's talk a little bit about how this compares to Goldman. Goldman made an enormous amount of money in fees for underwriting a lot of the bank capitalization that was demanded by the government. That's not so much the case with J.P. Morgan Chase, but they made an enormous amount of money really in their ability to, as you say, consolidate their mortgage business and really take much more control of the mortgage industry. How did they do that?
If you look at sort of where J.P. Morgan made money this year or in this quarter, it really is the same place that Goldman Sachs did in the investment bank. It had record revenues there from strong trading results in both trading bonds and commodities, where there are just fewer competitors left outstanding. And then you also look at, you know, after the stress test, all these banks needed to raise capital. And who did they go to? Well, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan.
Right. So basically, it is very similar to Goldman Sachs. Describe for our listeners what that means to make so much money in trading. I mean, it sounds a little bit like they took money from the TARP at a really low interest rate, traded a lot of oil, commodities, and bonds, made a huge amount of money, paid the government back, and everyone's happy about that?
Well, I think that sort of what it means is that banks really have two purposes. You know, there's the utility function of lending money, and then there's the casino function of trading. And, you know, the banks will tell you that they're properly hedged and they have all these, you know, intense risk management systems. And if you look at the results of J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs over this crisis and the management teams that they have, you'll get a lot of people on the street believing them. But I think the question remains, what happens a year from now when if those systems collapse or if there's another 100-year perfect storm in the next 5 years?
Well, and people are saying that until unemployment improves, a lot of these banks are still not going to be out of the woods. Bank of America and Citi earnings tomorrow. It seems to me that J.P. Morgan Chase's acquisition of Washington Mutual seems like a much better idea than Citi's acquisitions and Bank of America's acquisition of Merrill. Is that at least the takeaway that you can see at this point?
Well, certainly in the short term, I think sort of the verdict will be out in the long term. But I think that what you'll see is probably some similar results from both Citi and B of A, because both, you know, are remaining competitors in investment banking. And while they may not be as good because of all the distractions going on at those companies,
right,
I think that you'll still see a pretty solid performance, and that may surprise some people.
Happy week in banking. Eric Dash, banking reporter for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Preparing for liftoff with the acting director of NASA in just a moment. But first, headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Today is a big day for healthcare legislation. Bills are kicking around on the Hill, and President Obama meets with two moderate senators, possible swing votes. The president will be talking about the economy tonight when he speaks at the NAACP's 100th anniversary celebration in New York. We will have live coverage at thetakeaway.org. Also on Capitol Hill, it's day four of Sonia Sotomayor's Senate confirmation hearings. She will answer questions, as will witnesses. And happening just now, actually, I've just been running from the newsroom to check up on it. We have some of the nominations from the Hollywood Honours for the small screen, the Emmy nominations. Have a listen to this.
The nominations in the drama series category are
So I'll keep you waiting. We're just getting all that information in.
I'm going to hit you over the head with a bat.
And, of course, we have one of our experts coming on to tell us more.
That's right.
That was my Ryan Seacrest moment, that very, very long
really great.
Course.
Ryan doesn't have anything to worry about, I don't think.
Chandra Wilson of ABC's Grey's Anatomy and the breakout star Jim Parsons of CBS's comedy Big Bang Theory are actually going through the nominations right now. They're happening right now, so I will get that information to you as soon as I possibly can. Let's look at some of the big stories happening this morning.
Thank you, Femi. So 40 years ago, I was camping in upstate New York with my mom and dad, and we had an old black and white television that we rolled onto a picnic table to watch the landing on the moon, Neil Armstrong stepping onto the moon. Actually, 40 years ago today, that Apollo mission that resulted in the moon landing was launched, and it's a perfect moment to have the acting administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration join us here on The Takeaway, Christopher Scalise in Washington. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, John. How are you today?
Let me take you down memory lane here. I mean, I could roll clips from NASA for about 3 hours without stopping, but here are a couple of little highlights that I want you to talk about. But listen with me, won't you?
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Okay, that's, of course, the culmination of the moon mission. Here's another sort of sense of NASA's mission over the years.
With the experience and knowledge gained on the moon, we will then be ready to take the next steps of space exploration, human missions to Mars and to worlds beyond.
President George W. Bush speaking back in 2004, and this was just last night.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1. Booster ignition and liftoff of Endeavour. Completing Kibo and fulfilling Japan's hope for an out-of-this-world space laboratory.
Christopher Scalise, I could have chosen hundreds of different clips, and sort of we didn't even talk about Spirit and Opportunity, the little robots on Mars, but the NASA legacy is long and broad. And first of all, how is Endeavour doing this morning?
Endeavour and crew are doing fine. We're doing the inspections, or will be shortly today, to look at our thermal protection system, but right now everything is looking fine.
I played you the clip of Neil Armstrong stepping on the moon, and then, of course, George W. Bush suggesting that we go off to Mars. We haven't actually made it to Mars yet. And Buzz Aldrin, a former astronaut, has a op-ed piece in a newspaper this morning suggesting that that's what we should be concentrating on. What is the state of the Mars mission at this point, and is it a worthy goal for NASA in the 21st century?
Yes, I think it is. Mars has been, a fascinating subject for years and years. People have speculated about it, written science fiction books about it. And as you mentioned earlier, we've had a concerted effort to go to Mars and understand what's there. And every time we get there, in the early years with Mariner and Viking during the Apollo era, and most recently with Spirit and Opportunity and our satellites that are orbiting it, we're finding out more and more interesting things. As you know, last year we touched ice for the first time on another planet with a human developed system. So Mars is a very interesting place. It has some great potential discoveries for us, and humans can help us to better assess those discoveries and find them when the time comes. Until then, our robot explorers will be doing significant work up there.
Christopher, this is Farai. You're, again, the acting administrator of NASA. From what I understand, and this was something I got while visiting one of your facilities in California, a manned mission to Mars could take 4 years. There would be a huge amount of biological technology that would have to be able to keep these astronauts from, getting some of the bone density problems that they do when they're at the International Space Station, for example. I mean, how realistic is it, really? First of all, to send people to Mars, and secondly, to pay for it?
Well, I think it's very realistic. If we were to do it today, it would, of course, be difficult. But you identified one of the reasons that we have the space station. Since 1999, we've had crews living on the space station continuously, 6 months at a time. That's helping us to understand and extend our knowledge of long-duration spaceflight. So we need to build in steps, just as we did with Apollo, going from Mercury and Gemini before we and orbiting the moon before we finally put crews to attempt a landing on the moon as we did 40 years ago. And we used our robot explorers to pave the way to understand where the safest places to go. And that's exactly what we're doing today.
But Christopher Scalise, it seems that there is throughout NASA's history a tension between a political mission and a scientific mission. Here's Wernher von Braun, the rocket scientist, speaking about the Cold War and the space program back in 1959.
We have been told that the hammer and sickle flag has now been planted on the moon. And we have no reason to doubt it. I would not be at all surprised to be hearing a human voice from outer space that will have an unmistakable Russian accent.
Now, the fear that came from statements like that developed the space program as a race to the moon with the Russians. Of course, we won that race. But there are many people who say that the International Space Station is a ghostly reminder of Wernher von Braun's voice, that in fact it's much more symbolic than scientific, and you've said it demonstrates long-duration space flight sort of medical technology for us. But in a sense, isn't that a pretty poor use for a space station to just be a six-month hotel?
Well, it's not. I mean, you said it yourself. We're learning how to live and work in space. You know, it's an incredible achievement when you think that over several shuttle missions, working with our principal international partners, we built a station in space that's going to be, when completed, about 1 million pounds, and it's very, very close to that. It's the largest human-made object that's in space, and it carries practical benefits. Not many people recognize it yet because the investigations are just coming out, but as we go off and learn how bacterias and other things operate in space, we can develop vaccines for those on Earth. And one of the more recent examples is experiments up in space have demonstrated the possibility for a vaccine for salmonella, and that's just the first step.
What do you think the gesture, you know, 40 years hence would be from NASA, that the entire world will stop what it's doing and pay attention to, the way we did the moon landing 40 years ago?
Well, 40 years in the future, it could very well be us landing on Mars. And as we've seen with our robotic landers, whether they're landing on Mars, whether we're entering the Saturnian environment, or we're rendezvousing with a comet, as we did with Deep Impact.
Although President Kennedy said
the world pays a lot of attention.
President Kennedy said we will go to the moon. You said it could very well be Mars. It seems to be a change in emphasis.
No, it's not a change in emphasis. I mean, you're asking in 40 years to go to Mars. And, you know, we could very well be there at Mars in that time frame. But there's, you know, a lot of destinations along the way. We expect that we'll be returning to the moon, as President Obama has asked us to do and as President Bush has asked us to do.
And we'll all be along for the ride. NASA's vision of space exploration, in the words of Christopher Scalise, acting administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. He spoke to us from Washington.
And we are talking today about health care. Bills are in the works, including potentially some higher taxes for high-income people and penalties to employers who don't provide health benefits to workers. We want to know, would you be willing to pay more taxes in order to get better health care? Tell us your thoughts on the new health care bills at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. One proposal, John, actually would tax the health care benefits that you already get if you are a full-time employee. Not everyone's happy with that. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And of course, the NAACP is celebrating its 100th anniversary. Tune in and join me tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern Time to hear President Obama, plus our special coverage with some wonderful friends of The Takeaway. And here's your takeaway.
One will tear out one's hair trying to figure out the machinations of these hearings, but if you look at them as just a story on constitutional development, they're kind of interesting.
That's Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at Columbia University, talking about hearings for Supreme Court nominees. We are in the fourth day. For Sonia Sotomayor,
I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway.
It takes a Secretary of State.
I've seen the bellies of starving children, girls sold into human trafficking, men dying of treatable diseases, women denied the right to own property or vote, and young people without schooling or jobs, gripped by a sense of futility about their futures.
Secretary of State Clinton rolls out a global policy and herself after weeks in the background. With an army of envoys and a high-profile president, Clinton rolls up her sleeves. Excuse me, sleeve.
No doubt we lost some ground in recent years, but the damage is temporary. It's kind of like my elbow. It's getting better every day.
Have to admit, it's getting better.
U.S. foreign policy in the Obama era. It's a tough job, but will Hillary get a chance to do it? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, July 16th. I'm John Hockenberry here with co-host Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
How you doing?
We're taking a look at the Secretary of State's wide-ranging policy speech yesterday. We've also got another day of hearings for Sonia Sotomayor. There's a chance to look at the Supreme Court and the NAACP's legacy. Professor Lonnie Guinier is going to be here. How to market health care? That's a question for us, and a trivia question for all you Perry Mason fans coming up. But joining us right now is Afshin Mallavi, author of The Soul of Iran. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation. There's lots to talk about Iran, Afshin. But would you say this speech of Hillary Clinton, the sort of stepping back and looking at the larger implications, is really an end to the Bush doctrine of preemptive military power?
Well, I think what it does do is it ends the Bush doctrine of unilateralism. Clearly, we saw Secretary Clinton speak directly to that issue. And in fact, she called President Bush's idea of you are either with us or against us global malpractice, was her words. I think every president retains this notion that the United States can engage in a preemptive military strike in order to protect American interests. I think this president far less likely to use that than President Bush was. But what she really did do, and I thought she did very well, is lay out this idea that the United States cannot act alone. We live in a multi-partner world. And she didn't, you know, as we recall, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright once called the United States the indispensable nation. Secretary Clinton didn't go that far either.
Hmm. Well, we'll explore the details. Stay with us, Afshin Mallavi. Right now, everything you need to know this morning in the headlines. J.P. Morgan Chase posting a 36% jump in second quarter profits, way ahead of Wall Street expectations. More good news for banks. Staying with finance, new weekly unemployment numbers are out. Jobless claims dipped to 522,000. That's lower than analysts expected.
And President Obama takes up health care issues with leading moderate senators this morning. He may need those swing votes. And the president addresses the NAACP Centennial Gathering tonight in New York. We're going to have live coverage of the speech at thetakeaway.org.
Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor will take more questions in Senate confirmation hearings coming up. A huge commuting mess after a highway explosion near Detroit. A two-mile stretch of I-75 is shut down. The NASDAQ kicks off at 1862, the S&P at 932, the Dow starts trading at 8616. Healthcare reform, we're asking the question, what would you pay more for in terms of coverage? Taxes may go up. What would you pay for? 8778-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is playing tough.
Now, some see the rise of other nations and our economic troubles here at home as signs that American power has waned. Others simply don't trust us to lead. They view America as an unaccountable power, too quick to impose its will at the expense of their interests and our principles. But they are wrong. The question is not whether our nation can or should lead, but how it will lead in the 21st century.
One Washington Post columnist called her speech at the Council on Foreign Relations the "I'm back" tour. A broken elbow seemed to ground Secretary Clinton's travels, but the president just went to Europe, the Soviet Union, Ghana. Does this speech put Hillary Clinton back in the thick of things, or did she never even leave the fray? With us, we've got Mark Landler, the New York Times diplomatic correspondent. Mark, what stood out for you in this speech?
There's two levels to read the speech. One is what it says about the Obama administration's view of foreign policy and how it's staking out a different view of foreign policy than the Bush administration. The other way to read it is what it says about Hillary Clinton's role within the administration and the bureaucratic fighting that goes on inside any administration. On that level, it's clear the speech was an effort for her to inject herself back into the process in a big way. And there's no question that over the past few weeks, she's not only had lower visibility, but I think she's probably discovered the problem that happens when there's a perception that grows around you that you are maybe not exerting as much influence as people expected. People around her deny that's true and say that behind the scenes, she was a strong and remains a strongly influential player. But clearly a perception was starting to take hold in Washington that the State Department was losing influence to the White House. And I think the speech was also a way for her to address her own role.
Speaking of her role, she continued to talk about the U.S. role in the world.
For just as no nation can meet these challenges alone, no challenge can be met without America.
There has been some pushback from the international community as to whether or not America is, as one person I know put it, the referee or just in the game. What does this speech say about the perception of the United States?
Well, I think it says that the Obama administration is trying in a way to put its own definition on the idea of multilateralism. As your previous guest pointed out, a lot of administrations like to talk about acting unilaterally, working with allies. I think one of the things the speech tried to do was say, we have to really view this in a new way. We're not just talking about working with other allies. We're talking about working with non-state actors, whether it's NGOs, big corporations, other big players. And we also have to work with people who we don't agree with and who don't like us or support us. Hence the long discussion about why it makes sense to continue to engage Iran, even as she criticized the Iranian regime for its actions after the election in Tehran. So I think there's this attempt to say we are updating the notion of multilateralism for the 21st century, for a world that's far more complex with far more different actors that will demand us to put together coalitions that are more complicated and different than the types that you do in traditional diplomacy. And I think what a lot of people who listen to the speech and who think about this a lot said was, well, okay, that's fine, but now you've got to show this really works, and you have to really flesh it out in concrete examples. And the speech only began to do that. She didn't really take that notion too far.
Well, I guess a critic could point out, Mark Landler, and, you know, if you're a diplomatic correspondent, you have one view of this, but, you know, if you're running an NGO in sub-Saharan Africa, you might have another view of this, that it's one thing to kind of recognize a new reality of the 21st century, and she made all sorts of references to we have to work with other countries and multilateralism is a new reality. But then there's the question of what is the U.S. going to do with its power? And we talked at the top of the hour that preemptive unilateralism as far as hard power is concerned is probably off the table. But what's on the table? Do you see anything?
Well, she talked a lot about this idea of leading by example, and this is something I know she regards as very important. I think the idea is if the United States wants to lead on issues like climate change or energy security, there has to be an acknowledgement that we will also play by global rules. And one of the points she made was that when she went to Mexico a few months ago, she declared very openly, the United States is part of the problem with narco trafficking. Our appetite for drugs, fuels your narcotics industry. Similarly, with climate change, she said, the United States has to not only embrace the reality of climate change, but be willing to take the steps necessary to reduce emissions. Of course, the problem is With most of these issues, particularly ones like climate change, a lot of countries may agree with us on the problem, but they disagree or don't agree with us on the remedy. And it's much easier to talk about assembling a global coalition on climate change than to actually do one. So I think that, again, the challenge is making it happen, and that's not going to be easy in many, many of these issues.
Well, thanks so much. We've been speaking with Mark Landler, the New York Times diplomatic correspondent. John?
Breaking news out of Iran. The head of Iran's nuclear agency tells an Iranian news agency this morning, at least that's what the Associated Press is reporting, that he has resigned. It's another sign of internal turmoil in Iran since the recent election. But when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke of Iran yesterday, was it an aggressive critique? Did she describe a unique opportunity for U.S. diplomacy? Listen.
We know very well what we inherited with Iran, because we deal with that inheritance every day. We know that refusing to deal with the Islamic Republic has not succeeded in altering the Iranian march toward a nuclear weapon, reducing Iranian support for terror, or improving Iran's treatment of its own citizens.
Afshin Malavi spoke with us at the top of the hour about the secretary's speech. He's the author of The Soul of Iran and a fellow with the New America Foundation, speaking with us from D.C. So when she says we inherited a situation with Iran, does that give you confidence that this is going to be an aggressive policy, or that we're really just continuing with what the Bush administration has done with Iran by saying our patience is running out here?
You know, I think the clearly the Obama administration did want to take a different strategy towards Iran. And this idea of engagement with Iran, this idea of engagement with one's adversaries, is, in my view, not just a foreign policy position for President Obama. It's actually a domestic, it's become a political decision as well. And what I mean by that is President Obama took a lot of heat as candidate Obama when he talked about this. He took heat, frankly, from candidate Clinton as well on this issue of engagement with Iran. He took heat from candidate McCain as well. And now it's almost this election result in Iran has put them in a bind. They wanted clearly a victory by Mousavi, the reform candidate. They would have lived with a clean Ahmadinejad victory. But this kind of Ahmadinejad victory amid allegations of massive vote rigging and blood on the streets of Tehran massively complicates an engagement process that was begun several months ago. And this Iran has yet to reciprocate. The Obama administration has been reaching out to Iran for several months, and Iran has yet to show an inclination that they're willing to reach back to
the
United States.
Well, certainly Clinton yesterday didn't suggest that any sense of a quid pro quo or any of those offers were off the table at this point. Listen.
Iran can become a constructive actor in the region if it stops threatening its neighbors and supporting terrorism. It can assume a responsible position in the international community if it fulfills its obligations on human rights. The choice is clear. We remain ready to engage with Iran, but the time for action is now. The opportunity will not remain open indefinitely.
Now, you know, forgive me if I'm wrong, Afshin Malavi, but it seems to me that is offering engagement on the one hand, suggesting that there is not going to be engagement without some sort of precondition on the nuclear issue, which Iran has explicitly refused, and it sort of vaguely says that maybe this offer is going to close. That seems to me a continuation of the Bush policy.
You know, I think that's the general impatience. The Obama administration, as I said, put this policy out long before these elections. They have been increasingly frustrated by the fact that Iran has yet to reach back, and therefore, I think they're channeling some of that frustration,
right,
some of which comes from these elections.
Frustration, but what is new here? Afshin Malavi is from the New America Foundation. Thank you very much. We leave you now with the voice of Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C.
Neither the president nor I have any illusions that dialogue with the Islamic Republic will guarantee success of any kind. And the prospects have certainly shifted in the weeks following the election. But we also understand the importance of offering to engage Iran and giving its leaders a clear choice, whether to join the international community as a responsible member or to continue down a path to further isolation. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Farai today. I don't know if you were watching yesterday over in the Rose Garden at the White House, but it looked like a medical emergency over there. There were nurses and doctors and hospital officials, ambulance
drivers.
Or
maybe it was the presidential episode of Scrubs.
Yeah, well, it could have been. Let's hope it doesn't turn out that way. There were few laughs. The president was sternly urging Americans to focus on health care and to get Congress to focus on health care. Here's just one of the statements he made.
It's time for us to buck up. Congress, this administration, the entire federal government, to be clear that we've got to get this done.
The president is talking about strategy there, but he's also talking about policy. The strategy is let Congress work out the details. I'll take care of the marketing of health care reform in the United States. Here to talk about whether that strategy can work and what are the tactics necessary to take what is a House bill to the Senate and get senators to vote on essentially the same program. Celinda Lake joins us. She's a Democratic strategist and president of Lake Research. She's on the line from Washington, D.C. Celinda, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to join you.
Now, you know, this is the polar opposite of what the Clintons tried to do, to create a kind of think tank policy statement that then would become legislation. That failed. Here, Obama has sort of given the details to Congress and now is going to fight the big fight from the bully pulpit. First of all, do you like that strategy? And it seems to me the audience isn't really the American people here as much as it is the Senate. That's tough.
Well, I would say a couple of things. First of all, I think it's a great strategy. And if there were ever a president who could make that strategy successful, it's this one. He really has the ability to command the public's attention. He has the ability to really define things for voters. And one of the biggest problems we have is you have over 80% of voters who want health care reform, but they're worried about the nature of the package. You also have two-thirds of voters who like this president, who think he's doing a good job, who trust him on health care. So if there were ever a president that successfully defined this to the public, that it's this one. But you're right, the real audience here is the Senate, and it's important to remember that 50 of the 60 Democrats had the president win their state or come very close in a purple state. So that already gives us a running start in terms of when they think about someone who won their state, when they think about someone who commanded the bully pulpit in their state, I think that provides them the courage they have to make this kind of change.
All right, well, Celinda, let's listen to this ad. The Democratic National Committee is responsible for the content of this ad, but these are going to start running across the country to make the argument, the precise argument that you hope and the Obama administration hopes will make senators think twice about voting too aggressively against what's coming out of the House. Here.
My son has cerebral palsy and epilepsy. He's 4.
When I lost my job, I lost my health insurance, too.
My insurance company wouldn't fully cover me when I got sick.
My father-in-law walks with a limp because he didn't have health care.
My husband's job covered us until he was laid off.
It's time.
It's time.
It's time.
It's time for health care reform.
Now, those voices from advertising are contrasted with one of our listeners. Listen to this, Celinda.
I wouldn't be willing to pay one extra cent for health care. I think it could all be financed through control of waste, mostly in the legislative and executive branches. One less state dinner and fewer congressional aides.
On the one hand, you have a concern for policy and medical emergencies. On the other hand, you have cynicism about the government getting anything done. It's a tough road to hoe.
Well, actually, I heard your, it is a tough road to hoe. I heard your speaker slightly differently, which is, I noticed he didn't come out against health care reform. All he said was that he didn't want to pay more for it, particularly until politicians cut back on the waste and perks that they get, which is a pretty typical response. It was also interesting, it sounded like the caller was, a white male, and those are the people least interested in health care reform. People of color and women are much more interested. But there are two things I think that are key to winning health care reform. One is that you have over three-quarters of voters who want change. They believe we need health care reform in this country. And, in fact, we're releasing, our firm is releasing today with POS, a Republican firm, a brand-new poll that shows exactly that, that you have three-quarters of voters and a solid majority of every demographic and political group that thinks that we need reform of the system. The second thing I heard was that, the second thing we know is that the cost of doing nothing is quite large. Voters believe overwhelmingly that their health care costs will keep rising out of control if we don't do something. Well, and so I think that's a very important part of the message as well.
So, Linda, just a quick question. There is a possibility on the table that President Obama in this could look at taxing employer-provided health insurance as part of paying for it. Would that change the game? Would people say, oh, no, I'm not going to be taxed on my health benefits to pay for this?
Well, taxing benefits, I believe, is a very, very bad idea, and most Democrats have now come out against it, and you have 80% of the public against it. The House bill, of course, said, the wealthy should start paying their fair share, and for people who made over $350,000 a year, it said those people should not be paying lower tax rates than their secretaries do. So I think that the House version, which the president has endorsed, is the route to go here. And I think taxing benefits, which the Republicans are still for, but the Democrats are against, I think is a non-starter from the Democratic perspective.
Well, because it's involving taxes, it begins in the House. Ironically, it might be easier to market this to the House with the Senate in your pocket, but it's going to be the other way around, lobbying individual senators. We're asking all of our listeners what they would pay for in health care if they were being lobbied for health care reform. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Thanks to Linda Lake for laying out those marketing challenges. She's a Democratic strategist and the president of Lake Research. Now, Femi Okeh has our headlines.
Almost 29 minutes past the hour. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor spends her last day in the hot seat at her Senate confirmation hearings today. She will finish answering questions and then the testimony turns to witnesses. The president will be coming to New York tonight to help celebrate the 100th anniversary of the NAACP. He will take the stage to talk about healthcare and the economy, and you can follow the coverage live of his speech at thetakeaway.org. In Washington, D.C., a police shootout has left a man dead. Authorities say that he sped away from a routine traffic stop, hitting two officers before he finally crashed into a police cruiser. That's a look at some of the stories making headlines this morning.
Well, thanks so much, Femi. And, of course, yesterday, Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor faced another day of questioning at her confirmation hearing. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick was there for every single part of it, and he's been Twittering. We get the lowdown from him up next.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
And we are continuing our coverage of Judge Sonia Sotomayor, who faces another day of questions by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Yesterday, they focused on classic hot-button issues for Supreme Court nominees. We're talking about gun rights, property rights, and abortion. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick was on hand every step of the way. Todd, was there more substance on Wednesday than other days in the hearing?
A little more. Yeah, there were questions on internet, law, bankruptcy, even cameras in the courtroom and warrantless wiretapping. Of course, it also went to some of the well-known issues you mentioned. Republican senators are, of course, concerned about a ruling called Maloney, where Sotomayor did not affirm that the federally recognized individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment also applies to the states. So they're concerned that your state could still limit your right to bear arms. Even the Heller case in D.C. that was just this year said they really can't in a lot of ways. So they don't like that. And of course, abortion. Republicans want Sotomayor to comment on what they see as a flawed ruling, and that's Roe v. Wade. Everybody knows about that. It guarantees a woman's right to an abortion, basically by protecting her right to privacy. So here was Republican Tom Coburn, a conservative, who gave Sotomayor a chance to make her views clear on Roe.
Where are we today? What is the settled law in America about abortion?
I can speak to what the court has said in its precedent. In Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the court reaffirmed the core holding of Roe versus Wade, that a woman has a constitutional right to terminate her pregnancy in certain circumstances.
Well, that's actually important because leading up to these hearings, abortion advocacy groups were actually worried that that Sotomayor hadn't been nailed down on her pro-choice credentials. So she's basically saying here that the precedent is solid. That should assuage them a little bit.
And then we heard so much about her wise Latina comments. Is that part of the hearing over? Has everyone vetted it and done with it?
Nope. Sorry. It was brought up several times. One senator even apologizing for bringing it up and then bringing it up. But when it finally got around to Arlen Specter, who's on the Democratic side now, used to be the Republican chairman, he had this to say.
There has been a lot of talk about a wise Latino woman. And I think that this proceeding has tended to make a mountain out of a molehill.
All right, well, Specter might think that, but Republicans don't. It's still a big deal to them. John Cornyn, who's on the Republican side, said he just can't reconcile Sotomayor's statements at the hearings, that it was simply a bad choice of words and a mistake, with speeches she made, you know, four or five times around the country that he says basically celebrates Sotomayor's race and her sex, and that those things would make her a better judge than a white male. Listen to Cornyn here.
That's a problem. I haven't decided yet, but that's a problem. So hopefully with the next round of questioning and the other witnesses, we'll be able to get more clarity. But right now, we don't have it.
You're trying to get me started, Todd, and I'm not going there. I'm not. I'm just going to sit here quietly.
I know you're listening, John.
I'm just sitting very quietly.
Oh, come on. You have a question, but first let me go to Al Franken. He had his first go as a senator questioning a nominee. He's only been in for a fraction of this session. How do you do?
Well, this was a study in celebrity versus seniority. He's last in seniority, but all the cameras were on Franken. Everyone wanted to hear what he had to say. He is famous. He's the comedian. And he focused on some serious issues on net neutrality, which is internet law, on privacy rights, on judicial activism. You know, I got to say, the funny thing about Franken at this point is how much people want to be able to laugh at him, I found. You know, for the first few minutes when he spoke, there was laughter in the crowd and all this tittering, even though, to be honest, he didn't say anything funny. People were laughing anyway.
Like Saturday Night Live in the 80s.
Yeah. Although without the laughter, exactly, John. But he didn't disappoint. Sotomayor had told other senators earlier that her inspiration to become a prosecutor was the old TV show Perry Mason. And she said that Mason won all of his cases but one, and in every case except one, his client was exonerated, and Al Franken jumped all over it.
What was the one case in Perry Mason?
Well,
Berger won.
I wish I remembered the name of the episode, but I don't. I just was always struck that there was only one case where his client was actually guilty. And
you don't remember that case?
I know that I should remember the name of it, but I haven't looked at the episodes.
Didn't the White House prepare you for for that?
You're right, but I was spending a lot of time on reviewing cases.
Right. guy, John?
Yes.
The name of the case, Perry Mason, where he lost?
I have nothing.
I don't have it. Go, Todd.
The Case of the Dead Ringer, 1963.
Nice.
Good one. Now,
performing a service.
Just quickly, yes. What's next?
Okay, they're in round two of questions today, so more questions from senators. Kyle still to go, Cornyn, Coburn, and whoever on the Democratic side wants to use their 20 minutes. And then private witnesses, the most famous and interesting of whom is probably Frank Ricci of Ricci versus New Haven. That's the firefighter case. He was in the hearing room yesterday. He'll be testifying either today or tomorrow, probably today. It depends on how the timing goes. Former colleagues and friends of Sotomayor on the other side, including Mayor Bloomberg from New York, is testifying on her behalf.
Oh, it's a cavalcade of all of the political figures.
One thing, Todd, can anything happen in closed session that would, you know, derail what's happened in open session? Is there any precedent for that?
Yes, it can. That was yesterday. There was an FBI briefing on her background. That would be things like her tax history, hypothetically, you know, inappropriate contacts with foreign agents. I'm not saying there are those, but, hypothetically, anything in there. That they are, by Senate rules, not allowed to discuss any of that stuff. So we don't know what was discussed, but they did have that briefing yesterday. It was short. It was only about 20 minutes.
Many thanks. Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway Washington correspondent. And now we have Femi Okay with the headlines.
Thank you very much, Fry. I like the way you paused for the choir there. Almost 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama does a little Oval Office arm twisting this morning on health care reform. He will meet with potential Senate swing votes. Now, this comes as House Democrats plan to hold votes in two committees on the $1.5 trillion health care plan unveiled earlier this week. Fresh numbers out this morning on the job market. New claims for unemployment benefits were down last week, mostly due to the timing of auto layoffs. 522,000 people filed for the benefits. In international news, Iranian state radio says that investigators have recovered two of the three black boxes from a passenger jet that crashed yesterday. More than 160 people died when the Caspian Airlines flight went down shortly after taking off from Iran's capital. And back at home, Florida is fighting a plague of pythons in the Everglades. The state is launching its first official python cull. Here's Rodney Barreto of the Florida Wildlife Commission.
We're going to issue permits. We're going to manage and supervise trained hunters that will go out to eradicate the snakes.
Barreto says that many of the Asian pythons hiding out in the Everglades have been household pets that just got too big. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So coming up, the legal legacy of the NAACP. It's celebrating its 100th anniversary, but it has much more to celebrate than just simply hanging around for 100 years. Lonnie Guinier will talk about the legal struggles in civil rights then and now.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. The Emmy nominations were just announced today. Here is Chandra Wilson of Grey's Anatomy, who co-hosted the nominations.
The nominations in the drama series category are Big Love, Breaking Bad, Damages, Dexter, House, Lost, and Mad Men.
That was one of 16 nominations that Mad Men scooped up. Meanwhile, 30 Rock was the top comedy nominee with 22 nods. Here to tell us more about who's vying for an Emmy is Kim Potts, who runs the blog TV Screener. Now, Kim, is it a surprise that these two just kind of seem to sweep the table?
No, I think it was expected that Mad Men would dominate the drama categories and 30 Rock the comedy. The 22 nominations is pretty amazing.
It's
but
insane. It's too many.
It is kind of too many. There are definitely other shows that could have been in there.
You just wish that you were hanging out with Tina Fey.
And there's that.
She also got a nomination for Guest Actress on SNL, which was good with the Sarah Palin impersonation.
She got a nomination for walking down the street to get lunch at the deli.
Definitely.
Well, you know, Mad Men is a show that has gotten a lot of huge fans, and it's about ad executives back in the 50s. Let's take a listen to a bit of that show.
Crab Coulson guarantees there will be some astronauts there.
Really? My nephews would love an autograph.
Astronauts love golf. I'll see what I can do.
You're there to sell, but you're also there to listen. Every scientist, engineer, and general is trying to figure out a way to put a man on the moon or blow up Moscow, whichever one costs more. We have to explain to them how we can help them spend that money.
So what appeals about this show?
I think the fact that it's so authentic to that time, that right down to the costumes. I mean, they're very, very detailed about having that all down. Also, I think it's just kind of fun to look back at, not so fun for the way women were treated then, but it's very realistic, and it's interesting to see that. And it's also just kind of jarring to see these people drinking in their office at 11 a.m.
Smoking and drinking and smoking.
Exactly.
That was journalism 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, who do you think got shut out or left out?
There were a lot of surprises, both in snubs and people who did get nominations. The biggest snubs, no Best Drama nomination for 24, no Best Actor in a Drama nomination for Kiefer Sutherland, even though most people agreed the show had a big comeback this season.
And he makes more than many cable networks.
Exactly. And no Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series nomination for Jeremy Piven, who won last year. So maybe
from
the
Entourage.
Mercury thing still following him and people just not
we're done
loving
with Jeremy
him right
Piven.
Now.
We're done with Piven.
Yeah,
we're
I think
done.
So.
We're done with him.
Yeah.
You can go run along now, Jeremy.
Sarah Silverman, the acid-tongued comedian, was nominated for Best Actress in a Comedy Series for essentially playing herself.
Exactly.
Has that happened before?
Not really. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld was nominated on Seinfeld, but that was a little less real Jerry than Her Show Is Her. Just that one is kind of out of left field. I mean, it's a very funny show, but I don't think anyone would have predicted that.
All right. Well, the latest on the Emmys from Kim Potts, founding editor of the blog TV Screener.
Bing, bong. Bing, a bong, a bing, bong. Bing, bong. Television, say you love me. Television, say you care.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Seeking power and justice through the law, one of the legacies of the NAACP, a discussion with Lonnie Guinier when we come back right after headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. It's day four of Sonia Sotomayor's Senate confirmation. That's now underway. She will take more questions from senators, and then senators from both parties will bring in witnesses who will both praise and criticize the nominee. New housing numbers are in. Listing service Realty Track reports a 15% foreclosure jump in the first half of the year. That's more than a 1.5 million homeowners getting foreclosure papers. In Iran, the country's nuclear agency chief tells local press that he is resigning. The nuclear agency head is close to the opposition presidential candidate Mir Hossein Mousavi. Finally, the world's most expensive cigarettes were sold this week, but it was a mistake. Josh Mazinski from New Hampshire thought he was buying a regular pack. The next day, his bank sent him an email telling him that he owed them $23 quadrillion.
I thought my card had been compromised. I thought somebody bought Europe with my credit card. It was very concerning.
Maybe you should quit smoking, dude.
So Mazinski says the bank eventually corrected the mistake, and he can now see the funny side of having a debt larger than the entire country. That is a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Ben.
Today, the NAACP wraps up its convention celebrating its 100th anniversary with events including a speech by President Obama. Many historians consider one event to be the pinnacle of the NAACP's power. That's the Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Board of Education. It was argued by NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyer Thurgood Marshall. Now, that was before he himself became a Supreme Court justice. The ruling ended legal segregation in schools. The Legal Defense Fund was originally affiliated with the NAACP, but in 1957, it became a separate organization. And as we prepare for tomorrow's final takeaway broadcast on this historic week, plus a special we're doing tonight, we bring in Harvard Law Professor Lonnie Guineer to talk about the legal victories associated with the NAACP and today's legal struggles over civil rights. Professor, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
So how would you characterize the legacy of the NAACP and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund?
Well, I think you have to have a before and after. You mentioned that the two organizations split in 1957. And before 1957, there was essentially a litigation program that was tied to fieldwork and a network of local community-based branches so that the lawyers were working very closely with the community. After 1957, when the two organizations split, and they didn't split voluntarily, they were pressured to do so after the court case in Brown, because the Southern politicians who had lost Brown pressured the IRS to investigate the tax status of the two organizations. And once they split, then LDF became an independent organization, even though it was the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and the lawyers played much more of a leadership role independent of the local branch network of the NAACP. And as a result, you had, in many ways, a diffusion of the energy and a preoccupation or an emphasis on litigation as the solution. And you can see even now that many of the cases that LDF brings, and it's a terrific organization with a terrific group of lawyers, are cases in which there's no one on the streets, no one in the courtroom backing up the lawyers, because the lawyers are bringing these cases now independently of the community.
So it sounds like you're saying there's no grassroots at this point, even for cases like the 1999 class action suit on behalf of 350,000 minority and poor bus riders against Los Angeles. I mean, there's not a grassroots movement behind something like that.
Well, that actually was a case brought by the LDF LA branch, but the lawyer who was involved in that has left LDF and now works for something called the Advancement Project, which is trying to replicate the earlier approach of the NAACP and the LDF in terms of getting lawyers to work more intimately, more closely with community-based organizations. Connie Rice is the lawyer I'm talking about.
When you take a look at this historic split and perhaps go back in time to what happened between 1909 and 1957 when there was the NAACP and a building strategy of legal challenges, describe a little bit more about what that fusion of community and local interest and legal interest might be. How it worked.
Well, the branches were often at the forefront of identifying people with particular complaints about, for example, the black teachers who were concerned that they were not getting paid as much as the white teachers, the blacks in South Carolina who actually took a lot of the initiative and were concerned that their kids were not getting an education equal to the white kids, and in particular were concerned that the black kids had to walk to school and the white kids had buses. And they were the energy. They were, in many ways, a driving force behind the lawyers who came in to shape a lawsuit that represented the interests or the issues that were being raised by the community members. And what has happened since 1957, and it's a gradual process, and in many ways I may be overstating the distinction for the purpose of making the point, but in many ways, it's now the lawyers who are determining where you bring the cases, not the clients.
Hmm. In looking at the traditional history of civil rights in the United States, for so long, the judiciary has been the challenge mechanism for the power structure and the power elites in the United States to try to give people their constitutionally guaranteed rights. With so much of the power elite now shifted, and you've got such a tremendously symbolic moment of Barack Obama speaking before the NAACP, does it in any way change the impulse of lawyers or activists within the NAACP movement, or lawyers who are likely to do what the NAACP Defense Fund has done traditionally, to focus on the judiciary? Maybe it's better to focus on, you know, the White House or the executive or moving into the actual mechanisms of power in Washington.
Well, that's a very interesting question. Lawyers, particularly litigators, see their role as winning in court, and they often, especially given the way we teach in law schools, they often focus on the courts as the instrument of social change. And I think what you're pointing out is that there are other ways that lawyers can play a very powerful and important role, but outside of the courts, working on legislative change, working on administrative change. And in fact, when I was at LDF, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, in the early 1980s, my first assignment was working on the amendments to the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Wow.
And we spent all of our time working in Congress. But even then, in 1981-82, the LDF was part of a larger coalition that was based in Washington but had enormous grassroots support around the country. And what I'm pointing out now, and this is in some ways a contrast between 1981-82 and 2009, is that even though you had a massive organized effort at the local level to elect Barack Obama, that was a political effort. And
right.
You don't have that same massive organized community-based focus to change the law or to even change legislation in Congress.
Well, Professor, we want to thank you so much. And I want to point out that before you were a Harvard law professor, you went to Yale Law School with a former U.S. President Bill Clinton. Before you worked in civil rights, you were a 12-year-old watching on television as an NAACP attorney helped James Meredith get into the all-white University of Mississippi. I can only imagine what that did. Thanks, Lonnie Grenier, Harvard Law School.
Well, there'll be a lot of history on the dais tonight as President Obama addresses the NAACP at its annual convention, 100th anniversary. Our coverage continues tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. You can hear our special coverage of the president's address at takeaway.org. And on our website, Todd Zwillick's coverage of the Senate confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor is there. His tweets are going to be posted on our website. And a health care bill is in the works. What do you hope lawmakers come up with?
I would like to see a single-payer system like most countries in Europe have, and the citizens enjoy free health care. The notion of paying for health care is a foreign notion to them. That's what I want for our country. That's what we deserve.
Health care notions are the focus in Washington today. We're glad for you to weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.